The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Migration Nation. America's longstanding centers of wealth are losing droves of affluent residents to the Raleigh-Durham area, as well as far-flung locations once considered off the beaten path. The resulting ripple effects will be felt in the Triangle for decades to come. And this special report begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Money on the Move. Millions of Americans pulled up stakes for greener pastures during the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic, a mass migration that is consolidating wealth and disrupting the status quo from coast to coast. This is written by Craig M. Douglas. The majestic views in Wyoming's Teton County would never be confused for the towering skylines of New York City or Chicago, nor would a visitor find Teton's rugged landscape and relatively low-key profile much aligned with the congested, celebrity-studded streets of Los Angeles and San Francisco. That's about where the differences start to peter off. Teton is shaping up to be something of a poster child of post-COVID America, at least when it comes to drawing droves of high-income residents from the nation's biggest cities. The county, home to Jackson Hole and Grand Teton National Park, also exemplifies the strains that have resulted from that mass migration since the pandemic ensued, a narrative unfolding nationally in locations once considered off the beaten path. A Business Journal's analysis of federal tax and population data quantifies what most Americans already know anecdotally. The nation is in the throes of a post-pandemic reshuffling that will reverberate for decades to come. Approximately 8.7 million tax filers moved their primary residences to another U.S. county in the 2019 and 2020 tax filing years, taking at least $640 billion in reported annual income with them in the process. Many of those moves crossed state lines. Florida netted roughly $24 billion in income reported by new tax filers residing within its borders. Texas hauled in a net $6.4 billion from that inflow, while Arizona, $4.8 billion, North Carolina, $3.6 billion, and Tennessee, $2.6 billion, rounded out the top five states for income reported by newly minted residents. The largesse enjoyed by some of the nation's fastest-growing states equated to dollar-for-dollar losses elsewhere. On the negative side of the ledger, New York's $19.5 billion net outflow was tops among peers, trailed closely by a net $17.8 billion outflow in California. Illinois ranked third, losing a net $8.4 billion in annual income reported by individual income tax filers. In Teton County, where median household income was $92,488 in 2020. The average annual income for tax filers moving in from another U.S. county in 2019 and 2020 was $661,001, according to the IRS. Much of that wealth surge came from four out-of-state counties, California's San Francisco and Los Angeles counties, Chicago's home of Cook County, and New York County, also known as Manhattan. Those counties lost tax filers with a combined $102 million in annual income to Teton in 2019 and 2020. They averaged about $714,500 in annual income apiece in those reporting years, about eight times Teton's median household income. Like other destinations disrupted by the pandemic, Teton's home values have exploded in the interim, rising 35% to a median of $1.4 million since the end of 2020, according to Zillow. Similar stories are playing out nationally. Among the 25 counties to draw the most income from other states, median home values jumped 49% from December 2020 to July, more than double the rate reported by the 25 counties that saw the most money go out the door. And while there are a lot of maps and graphs in this special report, there is a second article written by David Pertell, Triangle Wealth Grows, Tax records detail just how much the Triangle is growing compared to other regions. It's no secret that the Triangle and North Carolina as a whole have been attracting people in droves from across the country in search of economic opportunities and a better quality of life, a trend that accelerated during the height of the pandemic. Now, new information on tax filer migration from the Internal Revenue Service reveals just how much wealth has flowed into the region and counties benefiting the most, and there are surprises. In 2019 and 2020, Wake County gained more than $260 million in annual adjusted gross income when comparing county in-migration and out-migration patterns among tax filers. The county gained nearly 4,000 tax filers, many from New York and Southern California, during the period, but the dollar figure wasn't even close to the leading county in the state. Brunswick County, which stretches from just outside Wilmington along the coast to the South Carolina border, saw $444 million of gross new income while gaining 3,400 tax filers, second in the state behind Wake. And just to the north, New Hanover County was third in the state with $267 million in new gross income gains. In between was Buncombe County, Asheville, with $301 million. The boom was driven in part by the trend toward remote work. High-income earners flooded North Carolina's coastal counties, pushing the local housing market to extremes. Meanwhile, Chatham County had the highest average adjusted gross income at $121,000 per tax filer migrating to the county. Moore County was second at $106,000. But for the Charlotte region, the picture wasn't so bright. Mecklenburg County lost $192.5 million in total adjusted gross income as many tax filers fled across the border to South Carolina, where COVID restrictions were much more lenient. It was a similar scenario for the Triad, where Guilford and Forsyth counties saw a combined $125 million leave. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Franklin Street begins to get its groove back. The return of college students has brought fresh energy to Franklin Street and Chapel Hill, where the pandemic's impact remains, but a revival is underway. In December 2020, the old Waffle Shop, a staple since 1972, closed. The space remains empty, as do other prominent locations, but new businesses are coming and others expanding as foot traffic rises. Matt Gladick, the executive director of the Downtown Chapel Hill Partnership, tracks pedestrian traffic through geofencing data from Placer.ai. For the fiscal year that ended June 30, downtown had 9 million visitors, more than the previous high of 8.7 million in 2019. If you look at how things are going, we had good momentum from 2019 and then the bottom dropped out, he says, adding, our pedestrians are here, our leasing activity is really strong. The return of college students and Tar Heel sports has helped. Gladick says UNC's win over Duke University in the Final Four brought a whopping 59,900 people to downtown Chapel Hill. Over the last 5 years, that's only topped by the 62,600 who came when UNC played Appalachian State University in football on September 21, 2019. Gladick says vacancy is now running about 10%. Rents tend to be high along Franklin Street and can reach $35 per square foot, but many businesses, including the Carolina Coffee Shop, have expanded. Raising Cane's, a Louisiana-based chicken concept, paid $3.87 million for the former Spanky's home and opens next year. And The Gathering Place, a game store and bar, is thriving in the former Bub O'Malley spot. It's just super fun, and they've done no advertising, Gladick says. They have just been crushing it. He notes that the types of spots that do well in Chapel Hill are local and have unique offerings. As the market picks up, even the former Ye Olde Waffle Shop location may get filled. There are a bunch of other things I can't talk about yet, but we hope to have some big announcements coming forward, Gladick says. Medical Giant expands in Johnston County. A global medical technology company is expanding in Johnston County with plans for a new manufacturing operation. Becton, Dickinson & Company will invest between $25 and $30 million in a new manufacturing site at Four Oaks Business Park. The New Jersey firm will construct a medical device processing facility that could initially span 30,000 square feet. Construction is expected to begin in 2023, with operations starting by late 2024. Former Keenan Flagler dean honored. Following in the footsteps of former Governor Jim Hunt and businessman John Belk, a former dean at UNC Chapel Hill is being recognized for his life's work. Paul Fulton has been selected as an honoree by the North Carolina Society of New York for this year's annual dinner dance. Fulton served as dean of his alma mater, Kenan Flagler Business School, from 1993 to 1997. He later served on the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees and the University of North Carolina System Board of Governors. Fulton is the founder and co-chair of Higher Ed Works, a nonpartisan public charity supporting higher education in the state. He will be recognized on December 2nd at the University Club in Manhattan. Past honorees include Dean Smith and Julian and Josie Robertson. The North Carolina Society of New York was founded in 1898 and hosts events for North Carolinians living in New York. When I was called about my selection as an honoree, I was shocked but truly flattered. What an honor, Fulton says. I love North Carolina and all about it. $100 million autism research program. Research centers at Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill will receive a multi-million dollar boost from the federal government. The universities are two of nine throughout the U.S. selected to receive funding from a $100 million program out of the National Institutes of Health focused on autism spectrum disorder. At UNC, the funding will support the continuation of a study led by Professor Joseph Piven that examines brain and behavior development in a group of 400 children who entered the study as infants and are now entering adolescence. And at Duke, Professor Geraldine Dawson will lead a team of researchers focused on developing new methods of screening children for early signs of autism. City Council puts hold on North Hills. Kane Realty's bid to rezone two parts of its North Hills project for 40 stories hit a snag September 6th when the Raleigh City Council delayed a decision. The move comes after the council has regularly approved such requests, largely when focused around downtown. Kane's application, first submitted in 2021, seeks up to 40 stories on two properties along Six Forks Road, up to 30 stories on one lot along Lassiter Mill Road, and up to 12 stories on one lot along Rowan Road at Six Forks Road. The matter is now open until the council meets again September 20. Resident concerns focused on traffic, the cost of living, and lack of affordable housing. And finally, Pinehurst No. 8 reopens. One of the golf courses at Pinehurst Resort reopened earlier this month after several agronomic and infrastructure improvements. No. 8, which originally opened in 1996, reopened with new TIFF Eagle greens, restored bunkers with fresh sand, improved drainage, and the removal of invasive trees. Tees and fairways were also phrase mowed to remove thatch throughout the course, which will tighten lies and offer more rollout on tee shots. No. 8 now appears crisper to the eye and plays firmer and faster the way Tom Fazio originally intended it, says Bob Farron, Pinehurst Resort Director of Agronomy. Fazio designed the course. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success, Earth and Equity. The headline, Enviro Risks on the Rise. UNC and the town of Chapel Hill are studying how to deal with weather extremes amid heat waves and episodic rainfall. Stories by Connie Gentry. About this project, the Earth and Equity Project explores the growing awareness, actions, and accountability of businesses and leaders who face opportunities and challenges relating to environmental, social, and governance issues, or ESG. The 52-week project will highlight what selected companies and Triangle executives are doing to address climate change, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and ways to maneuver the new world of corporate responsibilities. The Triangle is an oasis compared with the weather extremes and natural disasters occurring around the country, but the town of Chapel Hill and researchers at UNC's flagship university aren't waiting for a 100-year flood or oppressive heat waves to prepare for action. Working collaboratively, they're analyzing climate change and leveraging data to mitigate outcomes that pose risks for urban businesses and residents. In 2018, the town partnered with the Triangle J Council of Government on a regional resilience assessment that identified environmental risks, including increased rainfall, more 90-degree days, and the potential for drought, an assessment that led to Chapel Hill's Climate Action Plan. A key takeaway when we developed our climate action plan was the realization that we alone as a local government are not going to be able to solve or reach our community level goals, says John Richardson, community sustainability manager for the town. We work to develop a plan that looks across all town departments in our community, including a strong partnership with UNC Chapel Hill. Recent university research projects are providing pivotal data to help address the dynamics of climate change. The data-driven EnviroLab, or DDL, led by Angel Su, principal investigator at DDL, conducted a local heat mapping study in August 2021. And Mike Peeler, the university's chief sustainability officer, led the Sustainable Triangle Field Site project this past spring semester. The project studied ways to develop early warning systems for flooding, episodic rainfall, and if water level sensors would enable an understanding of flood potential. John and I nearly simultaneously launched climate action plans for the town and university that are intentionally coordinated to be forward-looking and collaborative, Peeler says. About 6 months ago, we released a water plan for the university that looks beyond conventional water management to how the university itself affects the way the water moves around in the built system and in the natural system. In Chapel Hill, the university mostly sits on top of the hill, so water flow is almost always off the hill away from the university. But we don't ever want it to be out of sight, out of mind. The spring project studied Booker Creek, noted for flooding challenges, most recently during Hurricane Florence when Eastgate Shopping Center flooded. The class put sensors at multiple locations throughout the creek to measure changes in water level during storms, which lets you see the timing of peak water levels, how much sooner that occurs upstream, and potentially use it as a tool for managing flood risk, Peeler explains. Data collected from the sensor showed that upstream by Lake Ellen, the water level peaked an hour and 15 minutes before it did in the Eastgate Shopping Center. If you see problematic levels at Lake Ellen, which is fairly far up in the watershed, you have time to do something about it downstream. Not a ton of time, but enough to put up floodgates in front of businesses and potentially alert communities in low areas, he says. Their research will continue in the spring 2023 semester and will help inform Chapel Hill's processes as the town steers plans forward. One layer of our work was to understand where flood risk is now, where flood risk will be when with climate change, and who is affected, Peeler says. In particular, students wanted to learn if the risk would disproportionately affect minority or economically distressed communities. As we look at solutions, are they going to help everybody or just a subset of people? In some cases, solutions end up harming a small group of people. Making sure that was not the case here was a big priority for our students, he explains. Evaluating the town's urban heat islands, or UHI, in the context of environmental justice is also a focal point of the data-driven lab heat mapping study. Roughly 40 volunteers from the university and community used handheld sensors and a mobile app to record differences in temperature and comfort levels between the hottest point of the day, 2 p.m. to 3 p.m., and early evening, 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., collecting more than 104,000 data points. Taking temperatures is about the environment, but 95 degrees Fahrenheit can feel different to different people, so we also want to know the perception of the heat, explains Zui Wang, DDL research scientist. A previous DDL study of the 175 largest urbanized areas in the continental U.S. reported UHI poses a major risk to public health, it said. It concluded people of color experienced higher UHI exposure than whites in 97% of the cities, and people living in poverty experienced higher UHI exposure than those with moderate or higher incomes in 70% of cities. Both UNC studies continue to be evaluated, but thus far neither suggests minority or impoverished communities are at higher risk in Chapel Hill. And now we turn to the On Tech and Banking page, written by Lauren Onasorge. SEC charges Lindbergh others with fraud. Lindbergh faces new allegations shortly after prison release. Embattled Durham entrepreneur Greg Lindbergh faces new charges centered on his business practices. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has charged Lindbergh, Christopher Herwig, and their Malta-based registered investment advisor, Standard Advisory Services Limited, with defrauding clients out of more than $75 million through undisclosed transactions. The charges came a day after a date was set for a new trial in a separate case where Lindbergh faces federal bribery charges. He was convicted and sentenced to prison following a trial in 2020, but a federal appeals court overturned the conviction in June. The SEC now claims Lindbergh and Herwig misappropriated more than $57 million in client funds and that Standard Advisory collected more than $21.4 million in advisory fees generated in connection to the schemes. The SEC says Lindbergh tried to conceal the fraud by using complex investment structures and a web of affiliated companies. Lindbergh, who founded insurance holding company Global Growth, formerly known as Eli Global, described the new charges as bullying by the SEC. "We did nothing wrong, and we intend to prove it in court," he says. In 2020, Lindbergh was found guilty of trying to bribe North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey for favors for his insurance companies. The SEC claims it all goes back to their new allegations. According to the SEC's new complaint, Lindbergh, Herwig, and SASL would recommend deals that were not disclosed to and were not in the best interests of their clients, and that included the insurance companies at the center of the criminal case. Instead of just using the insurance firm's coffers to pay policyholders, he treated the funds as his own assets and used the money for any purpose he decided was in his best interest, the complaint says. The resulting situation caused the insurance companies to become insolvent, the SEC says, ultimately putting them under the management of the North Carolina Department of Insurance, where they currently remain. RapidScale plans to move Raleigh offices to downtown location. From a tiny shared space at a serviced office complex to a new downtown regional headquarters, RapidScale's expansion from California to Raleigh has eclipsed the firm's initial ambitions, Raleigh site lead Dwayne Barnes says. The cloud computing firm has more than doubled its local headcount since 2019 and is preparing to move into the entire 13th floor of the new 301 Hillsborough building downtown that is already home to Pendo. Barnes says the firm's growth is driven by trends that emerged from the pandemic. "A lot of what we offer to our clients is the ability to work from anywhere in a secure way," he says. "Obviously, the pandemic fell into our favor from that perspective." RapidScale's parent company, Cox Communications, is also driving the growth. The Atlanta company has assisted RapidScale's sales channel in lead generation, driving up net new revenue. RapidScale currently has more than 110 people locally and plans to add another 40 people in the next year in Raleigh. "We expect nationwide to eclipse 300 total headcount next year," Barnes says. Carey firm banks $16.5 million in new capital. A Carey firm that grew from a small startup to a global player with Fortune 500 customers has raised more than $16 million in new capital from a London investor. Zift announced it has raised $16.5 million in debt financing, a round led by Ashgrove Capital, a specialist credit firm. The company, which has about 50 local employees, provides what it describes as partnership relationship management and through-channel marketing automation software to companies such as Cisco, Oracle, and Samsung. Its platform aligns channel marketing, channel sales, and channel operations, according to the company. The platform manages marketing and lead generation all the way through to sales. North Carolina ranks last in new index for workers. North Carolina ranks last on a best states to work in report from the left-leaning Oxfam America. It comes after CNBC put North Carolina at the top for best states for business. Unlike the ranking from CNBC, we're less interested in corporations themselves and really more interested in how the states are supporting low-wage workers, researcher Caitlin Henderson says. And finally, in a section called She Said It, a quote from CEO Kelly Frommer on how cloud giants survived after losing 20% of its business in 2 weeks after the pandemic hit. The 35-person Salesforce-focused consulting firm has had a steady 8-year climb, declining to raise outside capital and growing by bootstrapping and staying disciplined. "We had runway and savings to carry us for quite a long time," she says. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page written by Evan Hoopfer. Chatham County weighs managing growth. Commissioners debate options as county prepares for changes. A Chatham County Board of Commissioners meeting in August resembled, as one consultant put it, an economic development themed version of the newlywed game. The board is working on Plan Moncur, which will shape how Southeast Chatham County is developed as VinFast ramps up a 7,500-person manufacturing plant. The county is working with several consultants, and the commissioners addressed what would define successful development. Commissioner Diana Hales wants to maintain the rural characteristics of the county and protect the night sky. Chair Karen Howard wants a broad range of housing options for all income levels. Commissioner Mike Dasher said he was struggling with the vision side of it. We've got VinFast coming, so is the idea that let's imagine we have all the water and sewer we want and we can have quarter-acre lots, apartments, and affordable housing, he said? Or are we acknowledging that VinFast is coming and we're saying, yeah, we're going to stay Chatham County and we're going to preserve all this rural space and not have all of that housing and development? I don't see them as mutually exclusive at all, Howard responded. Innovative, modern housing projects take into account environmental factors. One of the main topics was the question of affordability. Howard lives in northern Chatham County, where home prices have skyrocketed. Howard wants to ensure that Chatham at large doesn't end up like, I'll pick on San Francisco. They didn't set out to be who they are. Let's make this a place where the 1% of the 1% can live and people making $200,000 are living out of their cars. But if you have a desirable place with beautiful waterways and availability of land, that's what's going to happen. We've seen our median home price skyrocket. We can't afford to be a place where only the wealthiest live. Greenville rejects apartments near Walmart. The Greenville City Council recently denied a rezoning request that would have paved the way for construction of a new apartment complex. Bill Clark Homes, which has offices in Greenville and Wilmington, was looking to rezone 13.84 acres along L.T. Hardy Road behind the Walmart on East 10th Street. The land would have supported up to 165 new apartment units. The project attracted fierce opposition from residents who live near the proposed development. The rezoning was debated for nearly 90 minutes during an August 18 City Council meeting and unanimously denied by the council. 300 new homes in the works for Oxford. Oxford continues to be a hotbed for residential development. Chesapeake Homes, which has offices in Raleigh, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Virginia Beach, Virginia, purchased 144 acres in Oxford for $1.35 million, according to a deed filed August 29. The land sits on the south side of Oxford Loop Northeast, near its intersection with Salem Road. On the land, Chesapeake Homes is planning to build 336 single-family homes, says Matthew Danielson, director of land acquisition for Chesapeake Homes. Danielson says development work is expected to start early next year on the community called Oakmont Preserve. He says it's to be determined what housing product will be built. And in a section called She Said It, we have a quote from Natalie Hawkins, president of Moore County Partners in Progress, the county's economic development arm. The Certified Entrepreneurial Community designation means that Moore County is entrepreneur-ready, and we have a robust entrepreneurial ecosystem that can help new startups and small businesses succeed. And finally, a big number, 9. The number of subdivisions totaling over 400 new homes that were discussed during a recent Johnston County Planning Board meeting. The county is one of the hottest places for new home development in the Triangle. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page, written by Zach Ezone. Life sciences get lift from federal grant. NC Biotech will take the lead as state lands $25 million investment. North Carolina's life sciences industry is getting a $25 million boost from the federal government. A statewide consortium led by the North Carolina Biotechnology Center is one of 21 winners in the Build Back Better Regional Challenge, a $1 billion program funded by a COVID-19 stimulus package signed into law last year. The federal grant funding coming to North Carolina will create new and expand existing workforce development programs throughout the state. The statewide coalition will invest the money into projects focused on three areas: workforce diversification, training access, and community engagement. The aim is to increase workforce development programs to meet the demand of existing and future jobs as more pharma and biotech companies expand in North Carolina. According to project documents, life sciences companies have announced the creation of more than 7,000 over the last 2 years. Through its Biomanufacturing Research Institute and Technology Enterprise, NC Central University will lead the workforce diversification effort, which establishes 6 training hubs at historically black colleges and universities throughout the state. This includes both Shaw and St. Augustine's universities in Raleigh. The training hubs will offer students hands-on courses focused on manufacturing biopharmaceuticals. The North Carolina Community College System will lead a project called NC Bio Better that aims to increase the pipeline of trained life sciences manufacturing workers. The effort includes 10 colleges throughout the state, including Durham Tech, Wake Tech, and others near the Triangle area. The college system will also expand its existing BioWork program, through which students can earn certificates to work as a process technician for biotech, pharma, or chemical manufacturing plants or companies. Meanwhile, NC Biotech will lead the community engagement effort by launching ambassador and apprenticeship programs to increase the awareness of life sciences manufacturing training and jobs. Doctor challenges certificate of need law. A new burn doctor wants the state's highest court to hear his challenge to North Carolina's rules regulating the expansion of healthcare facilities. Ophthalmologist Dr. Jay Singleton filed a petition in August asking the state Supreme Court to take up his case against the Certificate of Need Law, or CON. The petition follows dismissals in Superior Court and State Appeals Court of Singleton's initial 2020 lawsuit. Singleton, who owns Singleton Vision Center in New Bern, argues the CON law prevents him from expanding his medical practice to provide less expensive eye surgeries for patients. North Carolina is one of 35 states that uses a CON process to control the state supply of healthcare services based on what the state determines to be necessary in an annual state medical facilities plan. The plan identifies, for instance, how many hospital beds or operating rooms an area needs to meet community demand. Liquidia gets mixed rulings in dispute. Morrisville's Liquidia faces a longer regulatory path after a federal judge in Delaware ruled August 31 that Liquidia would infringe on one of 2 patents involving United Therapeutics. United sued in June 2020, claiming Liquidia's marketing of Eutrepia would infringe on 3 of its patents. The dispute over 1 patent was settled late last year, leaving the trial held in March to focus on the remaining 2 patents. Meanwhile, Liquidia challenged United's patents with the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, which ruled in July that the patent judge Richard Andrews found Liquidia to have infringed upon is invalid. This decision, if affirmed on appeal, would nullify the judge's ruling. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Damon Wade, Vice Chancellor of Enrollment Management for NC Central University, on the institution becoming a partner in Amazon's Career Choice Program. Launched in 2012, the program provides Amazon employees with fully funded college tuition. Anytime you can serve as a preferred education partner for a major corporation, you work diligently to make it happen. And finally, a big number. $1.4 million. That's how much GeneVentive Therapeutics, which develops gene therapies focused on rare blood diseases, recently raised, according to a securities filing. Co-founder Dr. Changwin Li invented its lead gene therapy program through his work at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brummett. Deep Dish Pizza Place lands in Morrisville. California Transplants open second location in the Triangle. Acme Pizza Company, first established in Holly Springs, is now serving its Chicago-style pies in Morrisville. The new location is at 2101 Grace Park Drive, just south of the West Cary Wegmans. Husband and wife team Gwen LaRussa and J.P. LaRussa opened their first restaurant in 2013. The couple previously lived in Oakland, California, where J.P. LaRussa ran a Chicago-style restaurant for about 25 years. After deciding to open their own restaurant, the LaRussas moved to North Carolina and opened Acme Pizza in Holly Springs. At the time, Holly Springs was on the brink of massive growth. The couple was entering the market, now home to a thriving food and beverage scene. At the beginning, the Holly Springs restaurant is located at 204 Village Walk Drive and measures 2,900 square feet. "We really hit a home run being able to open in a place like Holly Springs. We had no idea it was going to become such a populous area," Gwen LaRussa says. "It's really exploded in population since we got there. We were just lucky to hit it when we did." The same rings true for the new Morrisville spot, she says. The Morrisville area is known for lacking the volume and variety of restaurants that the rest of the Triangle boasts. It's really exciting to be a part of that and maybe be a part of attracting other places to come out here, Gwen LaRussa says. I would love to see a broader spectrum of food offered out here. The Morrisville location will have the same name and menu as the Holly Springs location. The restaurant's prized offering is deep-dish Chicago-style pizza, but the menu also includes hand-tossed pizza, subs, salads, and pasta. When the couple first opened Acme Pizza, they discovered that deep-dish pizza is not as common in North Carolina as it was in California, she says. Not a lot of people knew about Chicago style that weren't already from Chicago. We had to kind of introduce the concept a little bit, Gwen LaRussa says. The palate out here is different to that of California. Raleigh Hotel ends identity crisis. Originally known as the Origin Hotel Raleigh, the boutique hotel in the Block 83 development has announced another rebranding. The 126-room hotel opened at the edge of the Warehouse District in Glenwood South in the summer of 2020. Mississippi-based Thrash Group built the seven-story hotel and sold it in May for $31.5 million to Pyramid Hotel Group, also manages the Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club in Durham. The hotel is now part of Marriott's Tribute Portfolio brand under the name The Casso. When the hotel was sold, it continued operations under the name Hotel 83. The Tribute Portfolio is a collection of boutique properties, with The Casso being North Carolina's first. The name is a tribute to Raleigh's history. Casso's Inn was one of Raleigh's largest and most popular hotels in the 1700s and 1800s. President Andrew Johnson was born in a detached building on the inn's property. Downtown sees some energy after pandemic. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance's annual State of Downtown report showed year-over-year gains, but the numbers are still below pre-pandemic levels. In 2019, Downtown Raleigh office space had an occupancy rate of 96.2%. This year's report shows an occupancy rate of 88.4%. Downtown has seen a net gain of 386 hotel rooms, while occupancy has taken a dip from the 79.4% reported in 2019 to 67.4% in June 2022. Total food and beverage sales are down from 2019, but monthly sales exceeded pre-pandemic sales in five out of the first 6 months of 2022. Occupancy for multifamily properties changed by only 0.04%, with 2022 at 94.9%. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Rance Poehler, president and CEO of the Toshiba Global Commerce Solutions, the Durham-based company, a global market share leader in retail store technology, has hit its 10-year anniversary. Durham is the heart of our global retail operations, and we're proud to be one of the region's growing headquartered technology companies. And finally, a big number. $689 million. That's how much food and beverage sales accounted for from visitor spending in Wake County in 2021. That figure was 29% of total spending of $2.9 billion, according to Visit Raleigh. Retail racked up $488 million in spending, with lodging seeing $487 million. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Kaylee Thompson. Kane plans more apartments retail. West End development is rising at former Clancy and Thays home. Kane Realty Corporation has revealed new plans for the next phase of a large development that's reshaping part of downtown Raleigh. The Raleigh real estate developer announced September 2nd it will construct a mixed-use project with more than 200 apartments plus retail space as part of its ongoing West End development. The project will sit on 2 acres at the corner of Southwest and West Cabarrus Streets, across the railroad tracks from the Warehouse District. Kane anticipates groundbreaking for the summer of 2023 and completion in the spring of 2025. An estimated cost was not released. The new project joins Platform, Kane's first development in the West End, at the site of the former Clancy and Thays headquarters at 600 West Cabarrus Street. Platform will be a seven-story multi-building project with more than 430 apartments over 26,000 square feet of ground floor space, retail space. That project is under construction and scheduled to open in January 2024. The new project will have 240 apartments, 290 parking spaces, and 4,000 square feet of retail space. The building will be 5 floors of residences on top of 2 floors of parking, while the retail will be at the street level. Downtown Raleigh has seen tremendous growth over the past several years with no signs of slowing down, says Bonner Gaylord, Chief Operating Officer at Kane Realty. West End is a vibrant neighborhood with a fantastic variety of locally owned businesses. Between Platform and this newest development, we're thrilled to introduce even more options to live, work, dine, and shop in downtown's West End. Originally, Kane considered making the second development a mixed-use office project, but started changing course toward mixed-use residential in 2021. The apartments will be a mix of studio, 1-, 2-, and 3-bedroom units. Amenities will feature a top-floor sky lounge with views of downtown Raleigh, a pool with sun deck, indoor and outdoor community, and co-working spaces. Apartments plan near Apple campus site. Apartments and a coffee shop are being planned near Apple's future campus in Mooresville. Charlotte developer Crescent Communities is planning a 336-unit community on 13 acres on McCrimmon Parkway. There will be 10 townhomes and studio, 1-, 2-, and 3-bedroom units. The townhomes will be split between 2 buildings, while the apartments will be spread across 5 4-story buildings with elevator access. Director of Development Dan Gualtieri says Crescent has started a construction and plans to lease the first units by the summer of 2024. The community will be named Novel Mooresville and will include an LTH coffee and social coffee house open to residents and the public. The apartments will be within a walkable master plan community that is anchored by Wake Competition Center, the practice facility for the Carolina Hurricanes. Apartments near Crabtree to be revitalized. A Boston-based real estate developer has entered the Triangle market with plans to revitalize an aging apartment complex near Crabtree Valley Mall for its first local project. Redgate acquired the 51-unit Richmond Hills Apartments in May for $9 million from California-based Magma Equities. Site plans recently filed with the City of Raleigh reveal plans for an 8-story building with 330 apartments, 522 parking spaces, and 2,500 square feet of retail space. The 5.19-acre property sits to the east of Crabtree Mall. Redgate co-founder Damian Sari says the company hopes to break ground by early spring of 2023. The project cost will likely be above $100 million, he says. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Pritak Shandak, president of Raleigh-based Focus Properties, on how real estate developers need to accommodate Raleigh's changing market and its need for housing in accessible locations. Market conditions have changed, and developers, investors have to pivot and capitalize on existing untapped and underutilized assets. And finally, a big number, 1,000. The number of new homes a rezoning approval will allow on 279 acres in East Raleigh. The development will include 272 townhomes, 260 single-family detached and attached homes, 212 age-targeted ranches, 126 duplexes, and 90 cottage court units. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn some of our general and around-the-state news stories. Channel Advisor will go private in $663 million deal, written by Lauren Onasorge. New York-based Commerce Hub has agreed to acquire Mooresville-based e-commerce software firm Channel Advisor, taking it private. The boards of both companies have approved the buyout, which values Channel Advisor at $663 million. Deal terms call for Channel Advisor stockholders to receive $23.10 per share in cash, with 28.7 million shares outstanding. The price amounts to a premium of about 57% over the company's closing stock price on September 2nd. If the deal doesn't close, Channel Advisor could be on the hook for a $23 million termination fee. If a deal failure were linked to Commerce Hub, it would be on the hook for a $62 million termination fee. Rick Watson, a Channel Advisor veteran who is now CEO and founder of New York-based RMW Commerce Consulting, says the deal is proof of Commerce Hub's fresh expansion mindset under new CEO Brian Dove. Commerce Hub, which secured a major investment from Insight Partners last year, allows retailers such as Dick's Sporting Goods, Walmart, and Macy's to ship products directly from distributors to customers. Its platform was used to make $35 billion worth of transactions for more than 15,000 brands, retailers, and suppliers in 2021. With the addition of Channel Advisor, it will be able to easily link those brands to online shopping marketplaces such as Amazon and eBay. Commerce Hub made a similar move 8 years ago when it bought out Seattle-based retail technology firm Mercent, a Channel Advisor competitor. But Commerce Hub was unsuccessful at growing that business and winning market share, Watson says. I think this is their second bite of the apple at this marketplace market, which clearly Amazon is the leader in, Watson says. Channel Advisor was founded in 2001 by Scott Wingo and Aris Buenavicius. It went public in 2013 and currently has 368 employees in the region. Commerce Hub rarely does acquisitions. Its last big one was for a competitor, DSCO, out of Utah in 2020. While the DSCO deal directly competed with Commerce Hub's traditional business, Channel Advisor has very little overlap, less than 10% in terms of revenue, Watson estimates. But the customer overlap is thought to be significant. Commerce Hub's customers are primarily brands selling to retailers. Channel Advisor, with a revenue of $167 million in 2021, focuses on brands selling on marketplaces such as Amazon and eBay. And the next story is written by Elise Franco of the Charlotte Business Journal. South Park building sold for $80 million. Atlanta's Brookdale Group buys Rotunda building in Charlotte. An Atlanta commercial real estate investment group just closed on its nearly $80 million purchase of a recently renovated office building in South Park. The Brookdale Group acquired the Rotunda at 4201 Congress Street from Equus Capital Partners for $79.9 million, according to a deed filed with the Mecklenburg County. Equus, based in Philadelphia, bought the property in 2017 for $60 million. Chris Locatel, Equus Senior Vice President, says the 234,670-square-foot Class A office building is about 77% leased, though several pending deals are expected to bring the total to about 84%. Current tenants include Hendrick Gardner, Jefferies Financial, and Capitala Investment Advisors. We find it to be a great market to invest in, and the prospects long-term are favorable, so we think the buyer will do well, Locatel says. It's the type of property we like to put our touch on and return for our investor. Equus invested $4.5 million into renovations over the last several years to the building, which opened in 1988. Locatel says these upgrades made the property much more attractive to potential buyers. Renovations included upgrades to restrooms, the main building lobby, and upper floor elevator lobbies, elevator cab interiors, new portico lighting, cooling tower replacement, and new amenity spaces. Equus also made significant changes to the 4,500-square-foot outdoor patio overlooking Symphony Park. These upgrades were significant in a positive way and allowed the buyer to have a nice basis to add their own additional touches without having to back the truck up, Locatel says. Ryan Clutter and Chris Lingerfelt of JLL represented Equus in the transaction. Toyota's expansion tightens NC's ties to electrification. Electrification of the roads appears to have tremendous potential, not just for Toyota, but for builders, workers, suppliers, and governments in the triad. Toyota's recent announcement that it was raising its investment in its vehicle battery plant at the Greensboro Randolph megasite to $3.8 billion from $1.29 billion means that much more. Means that much more to go around in Randolph and Guilford counties and surrounding communities. For starters, there's a bigger tax base. When you're talking $3.8 billion, that's a sizable shot in the arm for Randolph County's tax revenue, and that benefits everybody in the county as well, Randolph County Economic Development Corporation President Kevin Franklin says. The benefits also will go to contractors and potentially suppliers. Already, Franklin says, there are local contractors working there on tasks. And then there is the potential for companies supplying the Toyota plant. For those in Tier 1 selling directly to the company, and lower down serving the top-level suppliers, and so on. We're starting to hear some inquiries from folks that would like to be supplying that facility and want to be locating in the region, Franklin adds. And that article's from the Triad Business Journal. And now we turn to the executive voice question and answer column, focusing on Kevin Sullivan. The headline, Charting Shaw's New Path. Sullivan sees opportunities for Shaw as it evaluates its real estate holdings in Raleigh. Interview by Zach Ezone. For a closer look, title, Vice President for Real Estate and Strategic Development, age 56, hometown Chicago, education, bachelor's and law degrees from Northern Illinois University, master's degree from University of Illinois at Chicago, family, wife and daughter, first job, selling newspapers from a newsstand. A historically black university in the heart of Raleigh is beginning the process of reimagining its campus, and Kevin Sullivan is leading the effort. Sullivan joined Shaw University in March 2021, tasked with helping the university transform parts of its campus through partnerships with developers. The idea is to bring amenities to students and the surrounding community while creating a way for the private institution to generate revenue. The university has proposed rezoning much of its 28-acre campus to a different type of mixed-use zoning that allows for greater development flexibility as construction activity continues in downtown Raleigh. The university has also brought on a consultant to help the institution determine the best uses for its land. Sullivan says that Shaw is not looking to sell off acres of its core campus through this process, but rather lease land to developers for projects that make sense for Shaw, its students, and the surrounding area. How did you begin your career? I got a BA in political science and then worked on Capitol Hill for a couple of years, mostly in fundraising. I figured out that the lawyers made all the money, so I decided to go back to law school. In 1995, when I graduated, I moved back out to D.C. and I worked for telecommunications company MCI. I worked in their real estate law department, where we were building out the local network. I was at MCI for a couple of years, and then I worked as a real estate attorney for Mobil Oil. I built what was downstream, fertilizer, gas stations, refineries. When did you move to higher education? I got a job at Virginia Tech's foundation where I was the general counsel, and I also handled all the real estate. I built over 1 million square feet of real estate for the university. That's where I got into mission-focused real estate. I built a dairy facility. I built a research building in Northern Virginia. I built an addition to our study abroad facility in Switzerland. It's all related, ultimately, to the mission. I went from Virginia Tech to Virginia Commonwealth University for a similar role, but I dropped the general counsel part. The big project there was they wanted to develop an athletics village. What about this role with Shaw interested you? It's the first HBCU in the South, literally born while the cannons of the Civil War were still smoking. Then you add in the civil rights movement activity that occurred here. It has tremendous history. Second is the location, the proximity to downtown and what's happening in the Triangle. The real estate guy in me is like, this is an amazing opportunity to redevelop something that looks like it's ready for that kind of redevelopment. What's the goal of Shaw's redevelopment effort? The goal that we have is to create this world-class student life experience. I've got outdated facilities. We don't have things the kids are looking for. It's really difficult to compete with the other schools as far as getting and retaining students because they come and they're like, what's there to do? What about generating revenue? I have a lot of empty fields, lots of buildings that aren't fully used, and to redevelop those in a way that, again, brings amenities as well as drives revenue, so we don't have to just depend on tuition. Tuition barely covers the light and heat bill. You can't fix up 100-year-old buildings. You can't build new buildings based on tuition. And we have a $17 million endowment. The revenue would help the endowment, which would help financial aid. It's also, frankly, to help bring the community in closer to Shaw and tie Shaw deeper into the fabric of the city. When would any redevelopment take place? My hope is we'll get entitlement approval in the first quarter of 2023. Concurrently, we're going out with an RFP to the market once we figure out the best area for redevelopment, and we're working on that with our advisors. Realistically, if all goes well, you will start seeing some construction activity in the first or second quarter of 2024. What has feedback been like at community meetings you've held? Everyone who has come wants Shaw to succeed. We have some folks who aren't as happy with what we're proposing, and we've got other folks who think it's the best thing, and they're excited that Shaw is taking the lead in this. There are folks who are concerned about gentrification and development in general. How do you respond to those concerns? Development is coming, whether Shaw does it or not, but we think we can be a much more holistic developer of real estate on Shaw's terms and with Shaw as the driver of it. We're not selling off 25 acres to the highest bidder and saying, hope it all works out. We're controlling this. We have every intention of being open, transparent, and altruistic in what we're doing. But we've got to do this if we want Shaw to succeed for another 157 years. What are the hurdles to this? There always could be a recession and the rates change. Also with COVID, you never know if the office market is doing well or not. It's trying to figure out how the whole commercial real estate market, hospitality, how is that changing? How is working from home changing? At some point, rent is unsustainable on its current growth trajectory, so how is that changing things? That's the uncertainty. And with our remaining time with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read as much as we can of the small business column written by James Lee, who's a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, Mom and Pop Shops Play Key Economic Role. The classic mom and pop in their shop, a little old lady and little old gentleman behind the counter in a store 30 feet wide and 50 feet deep, its shelves crowded with canned goods, sacks of flour and cornmeal and bags of dried beans. Their son, wearing a butcher's apron, mans a small meat counter, and his wife arranges neatly folded dry goods. Their grandson sweeps the floor, the iconic family business. Before you dismiss the idea of mom and pop with a snort, consider this. The term describes many characteristics of family-owned and other closely held businesses far beyond that little storefront. It can define a business's place in the larger commercial arena. It might refer to its management structure or style. It can indicate ownership or a business model. Far from being a term of derision, mom and pop is a useful way to identify a large sector of this country's business economy. A typical mom and pop has a particular place in the marketplace. It's just mom and pop, not much competition, huh? According to the Census Bureau, more than half of all businesses in the U.S. are family-owned, many of them mom and pops. The recent studies show that as consumers remember the comfort of touching and trying on, the lazy pleasure of purchasing online, and the excitement of the 250,000-square-foot shopping experience are wearing thin, and customer preferences are shifting back towards smaller stores staffed by warm bodies. The Internet Emporium and the Big Box are still with us, but the smaller mom-and-pop real people boxes, too. A mom-and-pop is often distinguished by its management style. Strategic decisions are made and often implemented in an intuitive way. It's possible for these businesses to enjoy management flexibility, especially if several managers and employees are family members, and to deliver their products and services on a just-in-time schedule. Their organizational structures might be flat instead of hierarchical, with somewhat relaxed internal dynamics. Come on in, the door is open. And due to time, we'll skip down to the last paragraph. But nevertheless, the mom-and-pop shop remains a vital element in the American business universe. Many family-owned businesses fit the definition, and they do more than their share of building and sustaining the local and national economies. And so we'll have to go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.